Hello and welcome to Baseball America's Draft Podcast. I'm Carlos Collazo, joined by Peter Flaherty. It is August 22nd on a Thursday as we're recording this episode. Peter, how are you doing, man?
Good. I'm fired up to be back on our regular weekly routine, and got a lot to dive into, so I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, absolutely. The post-draft summer is a little bit dicey in terms of podcast schedule for us just because there's some travel going on. I was on vacation last week, so I was off that week. But like you said, for the foreseeable future, it looks like we'll be able to do our weekly podcast. So we'll be able to dive into early performers from the 24 class, get some early insights and thoughts on 25 draftees. You've been heavy at work, Peter, on the site recently. You got a top 25 prospects from the Cape Cod League list out that you and Jeff worked on. You dropped your top 100 transfer board, which is just a beast of a piece on the site today as we're recording this episode. I've got 42 prospects who stood out from the East Coast Pro this summer on the site. So we'll get into all of those pieces a little bit later on in the show and whatever else you might want to talk about. But before we got into those kind of bulkier pieces that are on the site, I wanted to touch on a few of the kind of early debut performances from some of these 24 draftees. We just kind of took a look at where all of the players in the first round were assigned, if those players have been assigned at this point. A lot of the high school players and pitchers in particular have not really been activated in official games. But it is interesting just to see, I guess, which of these college hitters are starting off strong, how aggressively they're being challenged by their orgs. And unsurprisingly, we're going to start with the Los Angeles Angel here. Christian Moore, selected eighth overall by the Angels, underslot deal there. We all expected him to move quickly, and sure enough, just two games in A ball, and now he is in Double A. I think you could say he has had maybe the most impressive debut to this point for any 24 draftee, with the caveat for all of this following conversation that it's extremely small sample size territory. And I really don't know how much you can look at the pro debuts at this point, given how much these guys have played, given how worn down they can be. But I guess, first of all, Peter, I'll just say, like, is there a player who you think has had a more impressive debut than Christian Moore? Do you want to challenge that assertion by me off the top?
It's hard to say otherwise. I mean, even for the guys that have been assigned, we're looking at a really limited sample size. But I think of the limited sample size, you know, the Angels, as they have been in recent years, they're aggressive with their assignments and aggressive with their promotions. I don't think anyone's logged even close to 14 games in Double A, and what Moore has done in those 14 games has been really, really impressive. He's hitting .357. He's 20 for 56 with a pair of doubles, five home runs, eight RBIs. He got off to an otherworldly start. I think he was 11 for 16, 11 for 17 with four jacks. And it was like, you know, holy, like he was on, it was like he was playing MLB The Show on beginner mode, but he was doing it in real life. So yeah. He's cooled down a little bit since then. There's still some swing and miss. And I still do have my questions about the pure hit tool, but the debut has been really loud and really impressive. And it's hard to say at this point that anyone's even close to matching him.
Yeah, I mean, I made the initial comment out of the gate. I think he is the guy at the moment. He's leading all 24 drafted hitters in the minor leagues in general in total bases at 48. Pretty big gap between him and Jack Costello, who's number two at 34. That's Padres' 10th rounder. He's got six home runs. I believe that also leads all minor league hitters. Yeah, Nick Kurtz and Costello are right behind at four. There is strikeouts, but I've actually been pretty impressed with the swing decisions early on to this point. I'll be curious how that aspect of his game evolves, because I do still have some concerns with him long term. Like, how much are the strikeouts going to sneak up and be part of his game? He was 24-25% strikeout rate his first 2 years in college, and then made that huge jump forward this spring in his junior year, similar to what Chase Davis did a year ago, Cardinals outfield prospect. And those strikeout issues kind of popped up once he got into pro ball. So for now, I think I've been more impressed than I would have expected to be with Christian Moore's strikeout and walk rate. I did watch a lot of his video on Synergy, just his defensive chances, to see what he looked like at that position. And that might be my biggest concern with him moving forward, is he going to stick there? And if he does stick there, what is going to be the level of his defensive ability? I think it's hard for me right now to think of him as anything more than a fringy defender at the position. But I think if he can get to fringe average defensively at second, he has the offensive tools to still be a really solid everyday big leaguer. So, really strong start for him. Another player we have to mention here when we're talking about hot starts is Nick Kurtz. He played a little bit more in A-ball, and he has just fewer games in total, but he obliterated low-A Stockton, low-A California League pitchers, homered four times in seven games. It was a 1,500 OPS, more walks than strikeouts, quickly earned a promotion to double-A Midland. In his first game there, he got a hit, got on base, and he just looked good overall. I think both Christian Moore and Nick Kurtz are in the 99th percentile among all minor league hitters age 21 or younger in 90th percentile exit velocity, according to a piece that Jeff Ponce had for the site today. So that was cool to see. I mean, both with Kurtz and Kags, it wasn't particularly surprising. Moore, maybe I didn't think of him as quite that territory, but certainly in terms of home run production, those three guys are kind of the no-brainers. So he's another one that's got off to a really great start for Oakland.
Yeah, and I could be a little bit of a prisoner of the moment here with Kurtz, because his promotion was to double A was more recent than Christian Moore's was, and I know Moore's cooled off a little bit. But again, it's only a couple games in double A and seven games with Stockton, but I'm just as impressed, if not not more. It's hard to say I'm more impressed with Kurtz than Moore right now, but I mean, I'm just as impressed with what Kurtz is doing. He's flashing the plus hit, plus power that everyone touted him for in college, and it's translated well with Wood. Everyone was kind of questioning what it would look like with Wood because there was really no track record of it in college. He wasn't a USA guy. He wasn't a Cape guy. He would have been if he had stayed healthy through the summer. But nonetheless, he's looked really, really good. He's impacting the baseball on a very consistent basis. And he's also made a couple of really nice plays over at first, which I think his defense is probably his most underrated tool, just given that he's a first baseman. Yeah. And
I agree. There were more people at the draft who were talking about Kags as a superior athlete and defender at first base than Kurtz. And I just didn't agree with that assessment. I think me and you are kind of in line with how we view Kurtz versus Kags defensively. And I will say too, it is hard because I have always wanted to really like Nick Kurtz, and I've kind of tried to push back on getting too far in just because of the question marks about that profile in general in the past. First round first baseman just haven't panned out, but him starting off pro ball strong makes me really want to just buy into this profile even more, because with a guy like Jacob Berry, when he started his pro debut, it was pretty obvious immediately who's kind of flailing offensively, and the fact that Kurtz has just avoided that for nine games has me wanting to be excited. So I'm trying to temper my expectations and acknowledge that it is very early, small sample size, don't read into it too much, and generally my perspectives on these players aren't going to shift too much, or I don't want them to, at least. But it is just nice to see, and I think for both the A's and the Angels, these are two guys who took significant underslot deals, maybe came from further down the board than fans of the teams might have wanted at the time, depending on what your thoughts are on like undercutting at the top of the draft in terms of a draft strategy. But if you're fans of those teams, I think you have to be pretty excited about just the starts they've had so far.
Yeah, without a doubt. And even with Kurtz, you know, we're only 32 ABs in, and then with Christian Moore, I think it's something like, I don't know, 67 or so, but they both look really, really good. And I'm with you that first round first baseman is not the prettiest of profiles, but I think Kurtz, at least so far, I mean, he's looking like an anomaly to it. I couldn't be more in than I am right now.
Yeah, absolutely. And then I'll also mention the Angels have another player. They've got two of the three who are already in double A. Again, like if you're betting on this stuff, you would have bet on the Angels to have a prospect who gets pushed aggressively. But 18th rounder David Mershon is the third player who is already in double A. He's only played double A so far as soon as he got activated. All his official games have been with double A Rocket City. I didn't have much on him prior to the draft. You might know a little bit more about him now, but he's actually hit reasonably well. I mean, it's 10 for 33, hitting over 300 in his first nine games in double A as a 21-year-old 18th rounder who I believe signed for $150K. No, actually, that's wrong. The Angels had two significant day three signs, and Mershon was the other, in addition to Trey Gregory Alford, who I also heard was just touching 98 in some outings in Arizona, I believe. So Mershon is another really, really maybe interesting prospect to keep an eye on, who is moving very quickly to start.
Yeah, I mean, good for him. The assignment couldn't have been more aggressive, sending him straight to Double A Rocket City. He's holding his own through nine games, hitting a tick over 300 at Mississippi State. I mean, it's not hard to tell, but you know, he's a hit over power guy. He can run, he knows how to run. And you can kind of use him and plug and play him all over the field. And I think in Rocket City so far, he's got a couple of games at second, third, a few at short. They even stuck him in center field just to let him run around a little bit. So hit over power guy, can handle the bat. There's some feel for the barrel, knows what he's doing in the box. And good for him. He's handling the aggressive assignment really, really well so far.
Yeah, let's pivot to some pitching. Pitchers are harder to evaluate at this stage just because so many of these guys have not been activated. Teams are going to be very cautious with their innings in general. We don't have a single pitcher from the 24 draft class who's thrown more than 10 innings in pro ball. But once again, the most aggressive usage, I would say, from pitchers so far has been an Angels prospect. This is ninth rounder Derek Clark. He's thrown 8 innings and 2 starts, 10 strikeouts, no walks. Can't ask for much more than that for a guy who was drafted in the ninth round. Clark is kind of interesting because we had him, I think, on our initial BA 500 list. He was Mr. 500. In a later update, he got bounced off from the list, and then he was on our top 100 senior sign list. But he's kind of a really crafty pitchability left-hander who maybe doesn't have the loudest stuff. The fastball has played up pretty nicely to this point in A ball. So again, I don't think we can take too much away from this, but if you are trying to look at pitchers who have done well, Derek Clark has been pretty impressive, leading all 24 draftees with 10 strikeouts. Very small sample size, but that's cool to see as well.
Yeah, and I think it's really on brand that Clark's the guy, because I think when you talk about, you know, both pitchability lefties and also innings eaters at the college level, he is king. You log 97 at West Virginia this past spring. He threw 40 on the Cape last summer after throwing 103 and two thirds at Northwood, which is where he transferred. He's already made 4 starts, and it's strikes on strikes, and he's got 10 punch outs to no walks. I mean, he just pounds the zone with his upper 80s fastball, and he's got advanced feel for his changeup and slider. Changeup's probably a little bit better than both are really effective. So, he's a back of the rotation type of arm, but it's been fun to see him get off to a really good start.
Yeah, and good catch on the 4 starts, not 2 starts, that I said. So it's always nice having some accuracy, Peter, so thank you. Yeah, it's not all sunshine and roses for all the 24 draftees so far on their debuts. In fact, number 1 overall prospect on the BA board and 3rd overall pick to the Rockies, Mr. Charlie Condon, who tied for the signing bonus record with Chase Burns, has been struggling a bit through 12 games. I mean, particularly, I think the swing and miss has been a concern. It's 18 strikeouts and just 2 walks in 52 plate appearances at High A Spokane. Certainly not pushing for that Double-A promotion like Kurtz, like Christian Moore. 34.6% strikeout rate. The miss rate in general is kind of in line with that strikeout rate number as well. Definitely higher than I would have expected for a guy coming out of the SEC like him, who showed really impressive pure hitting ability. I mean, we had said over and over and over and over again, his hit power combination was some of the best, perhaps the best in the entire draft class. So that's not the start you want to see. Like we said with the guys who were out to strong starts, it's small sample size. I don't want to change my opinion too much on him this early. Are you at all concerned with this start, or are you more or less ready to just kind of flush whatever he does down the drain and get going next year?
I think a little bit of both. He was outstanding at Georgia, as everyone like getting it. There's going to be an adjustability period, especially when you're assigned to High A. They sent him straight to Spokane, and 48 at bats, like we were saying, for, you know, the Nick Kurtzes and the Christian Moores of the world who are off to really strong starts. It still is a small sample size, but like the one concern I had about Condon, and I hope and think we brought it up on one of the podcasts in the lead up to the draft, was, you know, looking past the, I guess, back of the baseball card stats and diving into the hit tool a little bit, and some of the concern against secondaries. And I think that that's been exposed, at least in the first handful of games that he's played in Double A. It's especially right on right breaking balls. I know that that was a struggle, and I saw it a little bit in the Athens Super Regional against NC State when they threw guys like Derek Clark and Jacob Duden, both with really good sliders and advanced feel for it, and they carved him a little bit. So I think that that's rearing its ugly head. But you know, he'll be able to adjust, and I'm curious to see how he adjusts and adapts. But I'd say that I am a little bit I'm more wary than I am concerned. I think that they exposed this really, really quick.
Yeah.
And like, he hasn't really gotten his footing, but again, he's a really good player. There are tools to be excited about, especially offensively, and you know, he'll get going.
Yeah. Condon and Travis Bazzano both tied with 18 strikeouts. The big difference is Travis Bazzano has five times as many walks and a 15% walk rate to go with that. So I think those are the names I wanted to hit on for early debuts for 24 players. We'll talk more about guys who are doing anything notable as the summer progresses. I guess we really don't have too much longer for the minor league season, which seems pretty insane. But Peter, let's pivot to some of your work on the college players. Like I said, you got your cape list, you got your top 100 transfer board. Which one of those do you want to tackle first? Because I think there's interesting stuff to talk about with both those lists.
Probably the cape, just because it's more, I'd say, draft focused. I'd say most, if not all, the guys on there are 25 eligible, other than like Joey Volchko. So
yeah. So I guess first question for you, I'll just throw this out at you, is you have Ava Arquette, number one on the cape list, with Chatham. Oregon State now, after playing with Washington, he also ranks, I think he's number one on your transfer board as well. So he's the guy to start with here. A year ago, it was Travis Bazzano. What's the talent level like? How is Ava Arquette as a kind of spotlight prospect for the Cape Cod League this year?
Yeah, I don't think anyone on this list really compares to what Bazzano did, and I know I've kind of taken I've garnered the reputation of being like the Bazzano guy, but it's hard to replicate what he did, hitting like 360 with eight jacks. But from a prospect standpoint, at least for me, Arquette was unmatched. I know Ethan Petrie took home MVP and top pro prospect honors, which, for those who aren't overly familiar with the Cape, usually one player wins MVP and the other wins the top pro prospect award. So it was a little odd to see him win both. He was outstanding this summer and no doubt earned at least one of the honors, but I was surprised they didn't break it up. I thought Arquette was going to be top pro prospect, but 6'4" shortstop, really smooth actions in the field. There's, you know, it's a really, really good body, simple swing in the box, easy impact to all field. I mean, he checks really all the boxes that you kind of look for. He said it at Oregon State, ironically enough, by way of Washington. Right now, he looks every bit of a future first round player. Like, there are tools to love now, and then there's also some stuff to dream on. So there's a chance he ends up at third long term, I think, defensively, but he's going to stick on the left side of the infield. And the game clock got better as the summer went on, and he kind of got his footing over at shortstop. So I was just really, really impressed, and I was fortunate enough to get three or four really good looks at Arquette, so that helps as well. But man, he's a dude.
Yeah. After that, there are a number of outfielders kind of in the 2 to 5 range on your list. Were there any other players kind of in this top grouping that were really exciting to you? Maybe personal favorites for you, not necessarily like the best pro prospects, but guys that just jumped out in any way that you wanted to mention here?
Yeah, so Nick Duminil is a personal cheese ball of mine heading into the 20. Like, I don't even know if you can call it that, because I think that he will be really well represented on future rankings and where he's discussed in the round range that he's going to go. But coming from Cal Baptist, he was a little bit of an unknown guy, at least nationally, coming into the summer. But I think he's anything but now. I think when you're looking at tools and the toolsiest guys on the Cape, Duminil is unmatched. Like, when it's all going for him, and from an upside and ceiling standpoint, there's legit five tool type of upside here with him. I think that the biggest thing for him is going to be shoring up the hit tool and the swing decisions. There are some pitch recognition issues that led to some miss and chase, especially against secondaries, but he's an elite athlete. It's easy plus speed. Both of those translate really, really well to center. He can go and get it in all directions, and he's got above average power to the pull side. I remember in the All-Star game, he had probably the best swing of the game. 106 EV, top spun home run that hit off the scoreboard in left field, and everyone was just kind of like, you know, whoa. But again, the hit tool's got to be shored up. He'll have a really good year again at Cal Baptist. Like, everything is going to look good, and I think he's well on his way to a first round pick. Ethan Conrad's another one. He's transferring to Wake Forest by way of Marist. So coming into this summer, not really a household name, but again, this spring he's going to be talked about in a really, I'd say, high range as far as the draft goes. But again, there are, like Dumanil, there are a lot of tools, not the five tools that Dumanil has, but, you know, he's a really aggressive hitter. There's power and speed. The hitability is there. And, you know, the body is, you know, you're kind of like, whoa, you see him get off the bus and he looks more like an NBA shooting guard than he does a college outfielder. Like, he is he's a physical big guy, and you know, he can drive the baseball to all fields, and I was really impressed. I think that the defense, I'm curious to see where he ends up. I don't know quite how the arm will play in right field where he was this summer. I think that a shift to left could be in his future, but the offense and tools in and of themselves, I think, will be enough to land him in the first round, at least for me.
Yeah, I'm glad that you're talking about some hitters here, because after doing Team USA's top list and talking with some scouts who got to really bear down on those players, I do have a few more questions about the top of this year's hitting talent. I mean, part of that is not seeing guys like Jace Laviolette, Cam Cannarella with Team USA. Seeing Jace Laviolette a year ago, it was pretty impressive, but just not having recent eyes on him just leads me down the board to some of the other top hitters in the class. And I think a lot of them have maybe more questions. Like, I didn't get the sort of wow performance from JJ Weatherholt that really makes me excited about someone at the very top of the board now. So it is nice to have a few names to maybe get a little bit excited about. What is your perception of the Cape's talent this year compared to either last year or just an average draft class?
And yeah, not going to
just like demographics, like I'm talking about with the, like, last year's hitting group at the very top, I thought was pretty impressive. How do you view it from your perspective at this stage?
Yeah, not to mince words here, but after the draft guys leave, which draft eligible guys leave, so a lot of draft eligible players, for those who are, again, unfamiliar, they'll come up before the draft and make a handful of starts, which leads to the pitching being really, really strong, I'd say, in the first few weeks. But after that, I mean, the pitching was awful for the most part this summer. Like, there was, you know, as you kind of got into the dog days a little bit in the middle of July and August, and guys like Joey Volchko were getting shut down, and you were looking around the league, and there were just a lot of arms that I think were hard to get excited about. So I think that it's definitely, which is weird to say, just given the trajectory that the Cape League has been on, I think it's a hitter's league, really from like the 4th of July on, which is interesting.
I mean, that makes sense with how kind of I've perceived the league over the last few years. When I started here at BA, it was like the Cape summer performance for hitters was uber important, because you get Woodbat track record against some of the better arms. And now I don't know that enough of the best arms in the country any year are playing in that league enough for it to be competitive enough to where I really put as much stock in just your Cape League performance as a hitter as I previously did. I mean, maybe like just getting a gauge on how power translates to wood bats is valuable. But outside of that, I think for most of the players playing in the Cape, the level of competition for their conference pitching is just going to be so much better, because all the horses are running.
Yeah, 100%. I think it is important to see, you know, how the impact translates to wood. I think that's what I'm looking for the most. And then obviously, you know, you're evaluating everything. But I think with a keen eye for impact, that's the key. But yeah, on the pitching side, if you're a weekend starter, really, if you're a weekend starter, Power 5 school, and even a weekend starter anywhere, you're almost certainly going to get shut down before you even make it to the Cape or after a start or two on the Cape. That's why the turnover has been so drastic across the entire league, and there's just been a revolving door on the pitching side of guys coming in. And towards the end of the year, it really starts looking more like, you know, the NECBL than it does the Cape League, because these various other summer leagues are wrapping up and teams are pulling from teams in other leagues to help finish out the season. So I think that it's taken a really interesting turn. But on the pitching side, at least from this chair, the most impressive arm was by far Joey Volchko. And I don't think that there was really even a close second. He's not even draft eligible until 2026, so he'll almost certainly be a USA guy next year again. That Stanford rotation is going to be really good with Joey Volchko, Matt Scott, and Christian Lim. It's going to be hard to top that in the ACC. Weird to say the ACC, but
yeah, that is odd. I was immediately thinking Pac when you brought him up, and now, man, we got that, and then Texas is joining the SEC this year as well, so need to get used to the new conferences.
We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search. Match with Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform of over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging. You can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. I think we're going to have an opening coming open. When it comes open, I'm going to use Indeed. Why? Because Indeed makes my job easy. When I'm hiring, it puts it all in one place. It organizes, it does the thinking for me to where I can just connect with quality candidates and do the process that we need to do to hire. That's what Indeed does. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Baseball America. Just go to Indeed.com/Baseball America right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/Baseball America. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Why are so many dogs suffering from health issues? Actress Katherine Heigl, who's helped save over 16,000 dogs through her foundation, says she's seeing more issues with dogs' joints, odors, and health than ever before. And after doing a ton of research, she feels there's one place we can look to improve any dog's health: their food. What she's discovered is that the way that many dog foods are made can actually create toxins that can be wrecking your dog's health. And this is true for even many premium brands. Fortunately, she's found that just by adding a few special superfoods to her dog's food, she saw huge transformations in their health. She's made a 20-minute video explaining step-by-step how anyone could do the same thing to see incredible changes to their dog's health. I've got two dogs, and I want them to be with me for a very long time. There's a lot of good stuff here that made me think about how most dog foods are made, what to avoid for my dogs, and superfoods that are great for them. If you want to keep your dog healthy and happy, go to badlandsfood.com/baseball and watch Catherine's video right now. Again, that's badlandsfood.com/baseball. The heat of summer is here. Whether you're going for a long run or just sitting by the pool, your favorite summer treat could be giving you extraordinary hydration. Liquid IV has refreshing summer flavors like Popsicle Firecracker and Rainbow Sherbet that hit the spot when you need transformative, hydrating relief all summer long. Indulge in hydration with electrolytes, essential vitamins, and clinically tested nutrients from the number one powdered hydration brand in America, Liquid IV. Did you know that blue and pink cotton candy are different flavors? I didn't until I started enjoying both of them through Liquid IV. Personally, I'm partial to the blue cotton candy. I make sure I pour some in my water bottle with some ice before I head out on a bike ride. It not only hydrates, but it's a more enjoyable way to stay hydrated. Blue cotton candy, that's my recommendation. But I've yet to find a Liquid IV flavor I don't like. Cool off your summer with the reimagined flavors of treats like Rainbow Sherbet and Popsicle Firecracker, or make your own Liquid IV popsicles. Indulgent flavors keep your wellness rituals fresh and keep you motivated and hydrated. Find all your favorite flavors on the website. There's acai berry, lemon lime, pina colada. You can even choose from their line of sugar-free flavors like raspberry melon, white peach, and green grape. The white peach, that's pretty good too. Tear, pour, live more. One stick and 16 ounces of water hydrates better than water alone. It's powdered by Live Hydroscience, an optimized ratio of electrolytes, essential vitamins, and clinically tested nutrients that turn ordinary water into extraordinary hydration. Three times the electrolytes of the leading sports drink, eight essential vitamins and nutrients. Always non-GMO, vegan, gluten-free, dairy-free, and soy-free. Indulge in hydration this summer with Liquid IV. Get 20% off your first order of Liquid IV when you go to liquidiv.com and use code BA2022 at checkout. That's 20% off your first order when you shop Better Hydration today using promo code BA2022 at liquidiv.com.
Yeah, exactly. But I think the cycle hasn't really even begun yet, but he is by far SP1 for me in 2026, and it's going to be hard to argue it. The one guy who he might even be a little underranked at 13 is Brandon Compton from Arizona State. I think if you're looking for a little bit of a player comp, not really, but in terms of a where he'll get selected in the draft comp, he's a lot like James Tibbs. I think he can be the James Tibbs of of the 2025 draft. The power is an easy 60 to all fields, borderline 7 to right. And what I was most impressed with was his hit tool this summer. There were some strikeout issues at ASU, not issues, but the Ks were a little high at ASU. There was some chase. But the approach and hit tool in general were excellent this summer. Like, he was in complete control of the box, picked up spin really well out of the hand. Like, it was clear that he was really, really comfortable and knew what he was doing against both left-handed and right-handed pitchers, no matter what kind of stuff a guy had. Like, he was in control, and he was consistently on the barrel. He had no issue shortening up with two strikes and just kind of letting his hands work and spraying line drives into the left center field gap. He is, unlike at least James Tibbs at this stage, he's definitely a left fielder, but for his size, I mean, if you look and see him up close, I mean, he looks like a middle linebacker. Like, he is like an absolute house, and it's a really good physical and helps him out. And he moves well for his size, in left field. There's some sneaky, I guess you could say, range to the arm side, but you're buying the offense here, and, I couldn't be more blown away, at least with what I saw. So I think 13, we might be underranking him a little bit. And then the last guy that I wanted to touch on was Murph Gray from Fresno State. Similar mold of these other guys like Dumanil and Ethan Conrad at Cal Baptist and Marist respectively, Gray wasn't, I don't think, a total household name coming into the summer, just being at Fresno State. But again, he burst onto the scene. He hit 323, 8 doubles, 5 jacks. There's plus feel for the barrel and advanced contact skills. And I think this summer he had an end zone contact rate of 93%. On the dirt at 30, he's a fringy athlete, but the arm is plus, and I think that he'll be able to stick at the position long term. I really, really like him. It's a great body. There's an explosive operation, kind of this compact explosiveness we talk about and like with these guys that are 6'4", 6'5", and 6'6". He's got some of that, and there's legit bat speed, above average power to all fields. I think he's going to both have a really, really strong season at Fresno, and then, you know, he is squarely a day one draft kind of guy right now, if not, you know, there's a chance, and I think a better chance than not, that he eventually ends up getting selected in the first round.
Yeah, and he also gets bonus points for having a name like Murph Gray. I think I'm at least putting a 60 on that.
It's awesome.
Murph with an F, too.
No, I love it. Thought.
So that's cool. All right, awesome. Well, if you guys want to see all of Peter and Jeff's full reports, full list on the top 25 prospects from the Cape Cod League this year, check it out. It's on the site. All of that good information is there to be had for BA subscribers. So thank you guys for supporting. I don't know if we'll have to talk about this too much on the podcast today, Peter, because as you mentioned, it's not as directly related to draft coverage, but I at least want to give you a chance to flex the muscles here on the top 100 transfers in college baseball. The transfer portal is becoming a much bigger facet of the game. Programs that have really become dominant in the game based on recruiting are now kind of, I don't know if it's been overnight, it feels like it's been overnight, but are basically having to pivot into team building via the transfer portal. It has changed how teams recruit. It has changed just the makeup, the demographics of teams. What are your thoughts on this year's transfer class? Unsurprisingly, a number of LSU players, most of the teams inside the top really 15 of your transfer portal rankings list are all SEC teams. I guess Oregon State can confidently claim that top spot as one of the outliers here. But thoughts on just the creation of this list, the work that goes into it, and any players that maybe are most intriguing to you from a transfer perspective?
Yeah, it's a ton because, I mean, there are 5,000 or so guys that enter the portal, and trying to whittle it down to 100 is almost impossible. So I'm sure that there are a handful of guys that, well, there are a handful of guys that had valid arguments to be on here, but I kind of went into it with a focus of both prospect status and the role that they would assume at their new school and all that. So it was, again, it was a fun activity and a tough one to whittle it down to 100. But like you said, LSU, as they, you know, they've kind of figured this thing out. Again, a really big winner in the portal. Daniel Dickinson, Anthony Ianson, Devin Sheeran, just a really strong class. And it stretches beyond the guys that I just mentioned in the top 100. They get, or the top 10, excuse me. There are guys further down this list that I think could be big contributors for them. And then the SEC in general, like you said, if you kind of scroll through this list, you'll see that a lot of the new school destinations for most of these guys, at least early on in the rankings, are SEC schools. But outside the SEC, Wake did a really nice job again of landing a handful of big time guys in the portal, Ethan Conrad being the headliner. Oklahoma State, they went into it with a clear focus, I think, on pitching and revamping its pitching staff a little bit, or not even revamping, just trying to maintain and build off the momentum they built this year with guys like Brian Holiday and Robert Kranz and Sam Garcia, Tommy Molsky. They had a lot of talent, but that's also a lot of talent to replace. So they're bringing in some firepower to help replace those innings. Oregon, I thought, did a really nice job. They kind of fly under the radar each year, at least for me, in terms of a team that has kind of figured the portal out a little bit and bringing in talent that, you know, they're going to be big time contributors immediately. And I think that this year is no different. I don't think they landed among the schools with the most incoming top 100 transfers, but South Carolina brought in a handful of guys as well. So I think the portal is going to be nuts, and it's going to continue to be insane because with the scholarship rosters expanding a little bit in college baseball and the new ruling, I think that there could be more of an emphasis on teams trying to recruit through the portal. Mm-hmm. So I'm really curious to see what this all looks like next summer and beyond.
I wanted to mention, I'm glad you brought up the college scholarships changing. I just wanted to mention this and see what you thought too. I feel like a lot of our dialogue about college scholarships has been much more negative than I would have ever expected. I mean, the 11.7 scholarship limit in college baseball has been probably the single biggest detriment to our game in general in terms of getting athletes into baseball. There are plenty of other things we could talk about, I guess, but I think that is like a main culprit in what has kind of held baseball back from just getting some athletes from other sports like football and basketball, where it's just easier to get college scholarship, or not easier, but there are more college scholarships available. And I feel like all of our conversation around this has been about how it is changing college baseball, and it's negative, and it's tougher for coaches, and it's ruining things for high school players. But for me, like, the first thing is, I think it's great that we have more scholarships available in college baseball. And yes, there is going to be a power imbalance now that there will be teams who will fully fund those scholarships, and there will be some schools who simply can't afford to. And so the already imbalanced nature of college baseball is going to tilt even more to that degree. But at the end of the day, the fact that more baseball players will be able to get scholarships to play baseball in college, I think, is a generally positive thing. And I'm just tired of the narrative basically coming from like the team perspective and the college coach perspective. Like, for me, this is fantastic for players. I have always been on the, it's a good thing if players from smaller schools really play well and then can move to a bigger school and challenge themselves against better competition. It's better for them moving forward. They're going to get seen more often. They're taken more seriously as prospects. It's a bigger platform. That's where all these players want to go when they're in high school in the first place. Yeah, it sucks that maybe this will make it more difficult for mid-majors to compete, but I really don't think there is any incentive, certainly from my perspective, to say like, oh, we need to really even the playing field for everyone, because there are always going to be imbalances. There are always going to be some programs that take baseball more seriously. I'm sure every single one of these coaches at every single one of these programs have told their players that life isn't fair. And I don't think college baseball is fair, but I'm glad we have more money available for players to play college baseball. And I just really, I've been thinking about this a lot, and I'm tired of seeing just nothing but negativity surrounding the college scholarship news, because again, for years and years and years now, we have wanted more college scholarships and we finally get them for baseball. And I feel like we just need to put a little bit more positivity on that news. It's great for players.
Amen. I couldn't agree with all that. I think that, again, there will be an adjustment and getting used to period for the, you know, the upping of scholarships. And like you said, mid-major schools, it could hurt them a little bit. But when all said and done, like, there are more doors that are going to be opened and, you know, more opportunity there to for high school kids to hopefully realize their dreams. And I think that as far as teams, how they navigate this, there was a Twitter post I saw earlier this summer, and it was, I was trying to find it while you, before we got into it, but
while I was ranting,
no,
you can rant a little more if you need some more time.
No, you're good. It was from a coach on the Mount St. Mary staff, I believe. And he was, you know, he was all in on embracing the transfer portal and kind of using it. I wish that I had the wording of the tweet, but it was basically like, hey, here's where our guys have started at Mount St. Mary's, and here's where they're now transferring to. And it was a graphic that included Virginia Tech, Central Florida, LSU. And I think
I love that so much. I think that is absolutely the model that these schools need to use, because it is a good thing if you are able to get players on campus, develop them, make them better, and then send them off to a location in a program that is simply going to be better for their future. Not every single team in college baseball can be the big dog, the top dog. It's just not going to happen. So the fact that he has like the self-awareness, and honestly, I think it's a separating factor. If you're a program that develops a reputation, this has been the JUCO route for years, right? If you develop a reputation of getting players better, really being good at coaching and sending players off to big programs where they can continue their career and continue making steps forward, that's a tremendous, that's a tremendous thing to be able to broadcast to your recruits. I think there's a space for that in college baseball. Increasingly, there's going to be a space for that. And I think, again, it just feels hypocritical to me a lot, because all of these college coaches, their goals are the same. They want to go coach at these big programs as well. A lot of jobs for them are stepping stone jobs, and they want to move to bigger Power 5 conferences. And then from the Power 5, they want to go to these SEC jobs. Like, there is a reason for that, and I don't think it is like necessarily this horrible thing for the sport. There are college baseball purists, I'm sure, who have loved following mid-majors and loved the Cinderella stories. But to be quite honest, I think for growing the game, the best players being in the SEC and those best teams facing off in the college postseason is better to create college baseball fans in general. The diehards who love the mid-majors aren't going to go anywhere just because all of the best players are going to increasingly be able to go to the SEC and the ACC and some of those other power conferences. But I definitely feel like I'm ranting a little bit too much on this podcast, Peter. I don't want to.
No, not at all. I mean, I think you summed it up really, really well. And I thought, at least from the Mount St. Mary's angle, if I'm like a high school recruit sitting there and, you know, mulling my options as to where to go, and if I don't necessarily have some of these big time offers that I was looking for, you know, you can make an opportunity for yourself really at any school. But if I'm seeing a coaching staff publicly embracing today's culture of the portal and kind of taking pride in the fact that they are sending these guys off to the more blue blood schools, I think that, you know, that's really cool, and I can feel confident with them having their best interests in mind and all of that. Because with the portal, like, and, you know, as right or wrong as it is, like, there are mid-major coaches that are a little more hesitant to send their guys out to the Cape so they don't get poached. And I think it's just a really difficult time to navigate. So at least for Mount St. Mary's to at least, and I'm sure that there are other schools that internally are the exact same way, and all the power to them. But for them to come out and do this in the public space, I thought was pretty cool. So,
yeah.
Interesting times ahead for sure.
I'm going to try and find that one after that and check it out and broadcast it a bit. Cause that is, yeah, I just think that's cool. I also think just one final point on this, like talk about high school players maybe being pushed out a little bit more in this new environment. I just think it's kind of a zero sum game. Like the roster spots are the roster spots, and the opportunities that high school players maybe previously got. It's just different players who are getting those same opportunities. Players from, like we've been talking about, smaller schools are transferring in to these bigger programs. Like, are those players any less deserving of opportunities for these big programs? I don't really think so. And from, like, the college team's perspective, if you're able to get a much less risky player who's kind of proven himself at the college level, has the sort of physicality, maturity to step in from day one, like, it makes sense from a team construction perspective as well. And maybe we're just going to see that there is more of, like, a really honestly, like, a minor league hierarchy in college baseball. High school players maybe increasingly will have to go prove themselves at smaller conferences and go to these programs who have developed themselves and made a name for themselves as being these stepping stone programs who can push you into the Power Five. Like, there are only more opportunities in college baseball now because of the scholarships for players. And it's just a different segment of the college baseball playing population who are getting the sort of prime time opportunities. Ultimately, for all these players, like, getting somewhere where you can get on the field and play, I think, is the most important thing. I'm obviously much more positive of the current college baseball environment than maybe some others. And probably that's because I have not been, like, a super diehard college baseball fan for my entire life. It's been something that I've kind of grown into here at PA. So that's kind of it for me on this side. But please, Peter, if you have any final comments on this, it is certainly the topic that is at the forefront of a lot of people's mind and people who often are really not focused on college baseball in general. So if there are any other points, anything I said that you want to push back on, please do.
No. I think the biggest thing is, you know, go where you can play. I think that oftentimes now we see kids have, you know, one good season at a smaller school where they kind of hit in the middle of the order. They play on a consistent basis and then they go out and leave and then they go and sit somewhere. I think that, you know, if you use the portal, I think to your advantage where you're, I guess just go where you can play. I think realize that the grass isn't always greener. And there's, you know, if you can play, you can play. Like, you're going to get drafted and signed for a lot of money. Yeah. No matter where you play, like, the opportunity is there. So I think that's, like, my biggest gripe with the portal is seeing kids, you know, play a lot as a freshman or step into a bigger role as a sophomore. And then because they step into a bigger role and do well, they immediately leave and think that they're going to have the exact same impact and exact same role at a new school. And then they end up not playing and just severely damaging their draft status or, you know, whatever it might be. So I think that, if kids can kind of realize that, you know, no matter where you play, if you play well and can share your tools, that you're going to get popped and signed for a lot of money, I think it'll make it a lot better. But that'll never happen. So it is what it is.
Well said. Well, let's pivot finally to some high school players. Like I said, I had a piece on 42 standouts from this year's East Coast Pro. It was really nice to get back to that event this summer for me. I missed it last year. Always disappointed to do that, but it was a great event. It's a scout run event. I think you always see a ton of really talented players. This year it felt pretty pitcher heavy, I would say. A lot of the top hitters in the class just weren't at some of these prominent high school showcase events during the summer because USA Baseball overlapped. I did want to mention at least, like, Cason Cunningham with USA Baseball, Team USA of the event in Panama where they were playing in. It seems like he's had just a really loud, impressive summer. He's certainly a prospect that you're going to want to keep your eye on moving forward. I believe right now he is ranked number 10 on our high school list for the 2025 class. But for some of the guys that I actually put eyes on in person who I was impressed with, I'd say number one, Landon Harmon, a right-handed pitcher from Mississippi. He was maybe one of the most impressive prospects just overall at this event. 6'5", great frame, tons of room to add more strength, pretty easy delivery, slight crossfire landing from a three-quarter slot. He pitched multiple times in this event. That's rare for the East Coast Pro. It's a fairly condensed event. Most people are running out for one outing, throwing two or three innings, sometimes just an inning, depending on kind of your role. But he was 93-96 for the most part, touching 98, mixed in a good 84-mile-per-hour changeup, harder 87-mile-per-hour kind of cutter slider, and then a sweeping 79, 82 mile per hour breaking ball that I think has solid shape and above average potential with a little bit more power and bite. But I think just in terms of upside, in terms of checking a lot of boxes physically, delivery wise, how the arm works, it's just a lot to like with Landon Harmon. So I'll mention him. My favorite hitter from this event was probably Daniel Pierce, who's a shortstop out of Georgia. Georgia has had a few tough years on the high school side, so hopefully we can maybe bounce back on the prep side for the state this year. But Pierce was a really exciting prospect for me. It's a high school shortstop, Peter. This is kind of my bread and butter demographic. I'm a sucker for these players. But he really stood out athletically, defensively. He just went 2-for-10 offensively with a double, a single, 3 strikeouts and a walk. So I think that while I do like sort of the raw power he showed, I think he has a solid batting eye and approach. What's more exciting about him right now, I think it's just the pure athleticism and the defensive actions at shortstop. He turned in a 70-grade run time in the 60-yard dash, the 8th fastest 60-yard time at 6.58 seconds. He also looked really good defensively at shortstop. Great actions in the field, reliable hands, impressive athleticism overall there, great arm strength across the diamond. So I was just really excited watching him. So he's another one that I would mention. Maybe a player who was also impressive to me with a little bit less stuff and doesn't have the sort of pure like really exciting frame or stuff right now on the mound, but has really pitched well in a lot of events this summer, is Ethan Grimm. He was 1-2-3, I think, in both of his 3 innings. 6 of his 9 outs were via the strikeout. He pounded the zone with a fastball that was 89-94, seemed to really play well with riding life at the top of the zone. Threw a slider and a curveball that both looked like they could be solid secondaries, maybe a little bit more fringy at times. But for me, just his pitch ability, the command of the fastball, getting ahead in counts, working quickly, getting outs. And then after this event, he went to the area code games, and he also worked 3 really quick innings, 5 strikeouts. I think he just allowed 1 hit in that event. So he's been really impressive this summer. And then I didn't see this outing specifically, but I have to mention him because he's just maybe one of the more exciting prospects in the class and has pitched well at the area code games. Seth Hernandez. He is getting some Dylan Lesko comps now, and I kind of, in my head, have always thought of him a little bit like Dylan Lesko just because of the two-way ability that he's shown. I think he's a much better hitting prospect than I ever would have expected. Like, in my mind, entering the summer, I just thought of him as a pitcher because he has just – he checks out every single box as a pitcher, 6'4" frame, great delivery, fastball in the mid to upper 90s consistently, a fantastic changeup. A high spin breaking ball. He's throwing a curveball and a slider. But what's most exciting is just the fact that I had scouts say, like, hey, when is the last time you've seen a changeup that was this good? And I immediately asked, like, oh, is it, do you think it's better than Dylan Lesko's? Because Dylan Lesko's kind of set the benchmark for high school changeups for me. And the fact that this scout was like, you know, I don't know which one's better, actually, now that you mention it. Like, it's pretty close. It is a pitch with tons of sink, tons of fade, typically around 10 to 12 miles per hour separation off the fastball. He has a ton of conviction throwing that pitch. It's just got tons of movement, tons of deception. It's a legitimate 70 grade offering. And the fact that he pairs it with a fastball that's been into the upper 90s, a great frame. He's got that athletic foundation as a two-way player. He is just a massively exciting high school pitching prospect. And maybe we will get another pitcher from the prep ranks to go top 10 this year, because I think at this point I would find it really difficult to line up 10 prospects from the 25 class who I would take in front of Seth Hernandez. And I just wanted to mention how good he's been. And I just think the Dylan Lesko comp is fun and pretty on point in a number of different ways, from like a physicality standpoint, from an athletic standpoint, from a pitch mix standpoint. And just the outlier prep changeup is kind of a pitch you don't see too often. A lot of these top high school pitching prospects aren't even really throwing a changeup because they don't need to. And for Hernandez, it might be his best swing and miss pitch for a guy who can throw 98. So that's pretty cool.
Yeah. No, I mean, I know he had probably the loudest summer circuit of any arm. And I'm with you, at least right now in the 25 class, he's won the number one prep arm, and it is hard to envision however many guys going in front of him. Another one that I wanted to mention, and I know he's more of a household name, but Eli Willits, I think from a performance standpoint, he was really good, as he kind of always has been. But from a makeup standpoint, I thought it was really impressive how He won gold with USA, flew out from Panama to make it for the last day. Just played one game out at area code, but he made up for lost time. I think he had a knock, a couple of bags, and then he did well in the high school All-American games as well. So I think that, you know, the baseball rat in him, and then I think my also love for guys like that. You know, I'm a big fan of that as well. But going into ECP, was there anyone, and I know it's hard to kind of have a stranglehold on the 25 class when you're also, you know, neck deep in 24 draft work, but was there anyone that, you know, going into the event that was more of an unknown guy for you, but you walked away, you know, a fan or, you know, kind of all in on him?
Yeah.
You may have talked about it already. So
no, I think, I mean, for me, Pierce is kind of the cheese ball that I really liked, just cause I like that profile, I like the athlete. I like the swing maybe more than like the performance that he's shown, indicates. I'm probably higher on him as a hitter than some of the scouts I've talked to so far, but, I just really came away liking him. I think for me, this event was also a lot of fun because it really was the first event that I could go to and really just sink my teeth into it without having to worry about the 24 draft class. I remember just going to, I'm not sure what exactly it was, a few events prior to the draft taking place where I just felt very muddled, just in my head. I really couldn't sink my teeth into these players and really feel like I got good looks at them because I was just juggling too much stuff. There were some players that I kind of really like. Logan Dawson is one that I liked. He's a shortstop out of New Jersey, Boston College commit, lean frame, 6 foot three, 190 pounds. I really loved his approach, his at bats. He's not the fastest runner. I'm not sure if he's the toolsiest player right now, but I came away impressed with just his swing decisions and the quality of his ABs regularly. He walked four times, struck out six times. There's some swing and miss against elevated fastballs that he showed, but I liked him for whatever reason, despite like not having the greatest performance numbers. I think a few other pitchers I would mention: Coleman Borthwick, a right-handed pitcher out of Florida, is a massive right-hander, 6'6", 245 pounds, sat 91-95, got misses with the fastball, had both a breaking ball at 80-81, three-quarter curveball, and then an 82-84 mile per hour changeup that he threw with fastball arm speed. So he checked a lot of boxes in terms of just size, three-pitch mix, decent strikes. I thought actually Ethan Ball, who is a shortstop at McLean High School in Virginia, which is really close to me, he had the most impressive batting practice round of any player at the entire East Coast Pro. I was really excited to see him in games. And then games came, and it was a ton of swing and miss, a lot more than I expected. He went hitless in 10 at-bats, or 10 plate appearances, 6 strikeouts, and 1 walk. I'm really intrigued with him just because that BP was so impressive. I mean, he was backspinning balls to straightaway center field, showing a lot more power than I would have expected given the frame, quick, snappy hands. He also turned in a plus run time. So he's a player that I'm really intrigued by. Again, another hitter that I'm kind of fascinated with, who didn't just wow me with performance in game. Let me see if there are any others that I missed. Coy James didn't really have the best event, I would say, but he hit a few balls pretty hard. Another player who stood out in batting practice, just like the swing, like the overall package for him. Those would be some of the other guys who stood out. Dean Moss is a top player in this class. We've got him ranked, I believe, right inside the top 10, a few spots in front of Cason Cunningham. He's a smaller outfielder, 6 foot, 185 pounds, tons of bat speed. He performed pretty well, quality at bats, hits the ball hard. I'm intrigued by him. I do think he maybe has a little bit of a tweener profile, so I'll be interested to see like what scouts are talking about him moving forward. Because if he can't play center field, he doesn't have like the typical size for right field, but he might be better in a corner long term. Need to see a lot more of all these guys, obviously. But those are some other names who stood out for me. Reed Worley, a right-handed pitcher out of Georgia, spin monster. That'd be another one to mention. But yeah, it was really fun to see these guys and get good looks on them. I'm still like kind of organizing a lot of my notes and trying to really put these guys, line them up in my head as I have conversations with scouts and get caught up on all this high school action over the summer.
Yeah, without a doubt. It's always a great event, and there's no shortage of talent every year. I like that it's scout run too. So yeah. It's always a great one.
Absolutely. Cool. Well, I think that's going to do it for today for us on the podcast. Peter, anything you want to plug, anything you want to mention or shout out before we sign off here?
Yeah, I mean, the as we kind of alluded to at the beginning of the podcast, there are a lot of really cool pieces up on the site right now. 50 area code underclass standouts, 42 ECP standouts. You have CAPE rankings if that's kind of your jam, and then the top 100 transfer big board is that's a big one as well. So there's stuff up there now. There's stuff that's going to be up there next week. I think at the end of the week, as we head into week 1 of the college baseball season, I'm going to try my hand at what Teddy used to do with it, which is college baseball or college football standouts that, you know, had a little bit of a baseball career.
Yeah,
we still are having a baseball career. There are no Will Taylors this year, but still, I'll try my hand at that. So that'll be fun. And then
I'm really dreading football season starting up because I'm going to have to start actively managing the two fantasy football leagues that I'm in. And I don't really want to do that. I've enjoyed not having to manage those teams. So I'll have to get back on the grind for that. But for me, in terms of content on the site, as you're listening to this podcast, I should have a piece out on the website. It's a piece I did last year, replicated it again this year, just looking into how each team spent in the 2024 draft. So if you are like super nerdy for the draft and you like getting into spending strategies, who went over the full 5% overage, which team spent early, which team spent late, who was really heavy on day 3 players, who was really heavy on seniors, all that kind of nitty gritty, super in the weeds draft info and breaking down the finances of this year's draft. I like doing that piece. I'm not sure how many people actually get amped up about it, but every team is kind of broken down and bucketed into the 4 sort of main spending strategies that I've identified, at least. So that's a fun piece for me to do. That will be on the site. Next week, I'll also have the high school showcase standouts team. That's kind of a piece we've done a few years now. It'll be coming back. I've spent the last few days talking with scouts about kind of the best options for that team. It's been tough to really get the finalists here at a number of positions. So there are a lot of guys who are kind of making really strong cases. It's going to be tough to kind of cut down the final team, but that's what I've been working on. So yeah, things are moving around this summer. We should be back again next week for another draft podcast. So if you guys have any questions that you want to throw at us that you want me and Peter to talk about or break down, we'll be happy to do that. But I'm excited to kind of get back into our normal groove, Peter. This has been fun.
Yeah, you and me both. I'm fired up to get back on the saddle.
All right. Well, thank you guys for listening. Thank you for supporting Baseball America. If you do not, and you've been interested in this conversation and you've thought about it, maybe consider it, because we still have plenty of content coming, even if we are past the like craziness season that is mid-July. There's plenty of stuff to talk about. Jeff had a few good pieces this week, actually, digging into some stats and analysis for minor league players. 15 players with top exit velocities was another piece that he had. So yeah, we got plenty of stuff coming. So again, thank you guys. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.